This is Age of Treason Radio.
First thing I remember was asking Papa why. For there were many things I didn't know.
On the White Network.
By the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's gone. You better learn your past, you better learn your young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Good evening, everyone. The title of tonight's installment is White Flight. This is a tale of cause and effect, really. It's tied to what I talked about last week. That was about discrimination and exclusion, and specifically how discrimination in favor of whites and exclusion of anyone by whites has been pathologized and demonized and even criminalized. When it comes to discrimination and exclusion, we're not even innocent until proven guilty. We're just assumed to be guilty. We're guilty if there are too many whites, if there's not enough diversity. It's pretty much the same thing. Regardless of whether the situation is good for whites or the way we want it to be. In contrast, when there are too many non-whites, that's only considered bad if the non-whites think it's bad for themselves. So why is this? Why this double standard? Why are we treated differently? Well, the experts, the intellectuals who come up with these ideas, they use moral arguments to justify them. They say that it's immoral, it's wrong, it's bad for whites to exclude non-whites, specifically because it's perceived to be bad for the non-whites. In fact, whenever and wherever forced integration is considered best for the non-whites, then whites are compelled to integrate for the same reason. The ruler makes the rules. And in this regard, it's clear whites don't rule America. I can't speak for any other country. I live in America, and I know that situation here best. Whites may hold office here, but they don't do their business from day to day as self-conscious whites with the best interests of whites in mind, unlike other groups. At best, the whites who shape the policy and make decisions are doing so with the best interests of everybody in mind. And often it's in agreement with these experts who have the best interests of everybody but whites in mind. In contrast, when whites ruled, race mixing was socially unacceptable everywhere and illegal in many places, specifically because it was deemed best for whites, and that was the sign that whites were in charge, is that things were done because they benefited whites and regardless of the effect that they had on others. Today we have the opposite situation. So I'm going to talk about forced racial integration. I'm going to talk about three different aspects of that, and then I'm going to talk about the effects of those causes. I'll start with the EEOC, which is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And I went to their homepage today and found on the homepage a link to a special report on what you should know about the EEOC and religious and national origin discrimination involving the Muslim, Sikh, Arab, Middle Eastern, and South Asian communities. And by involving, they meant only as victims, not as perpetrators. If you go and you read what's at this link, it's a very one-sided view. They don't talk about how these groups could possibly be discriminating against other groups, against each other or against whites. It's only one side that they are being discriminated against. that's even considered in this government report. Elsewhere on the homepage for the EEOC, and well, yeah, elsewhere on the homepage is a link to a report on Texas Roadhouse litigation. There, the EEOC is suing Texas Roadhouse, which is a chain of restaurants, because it's not hiring enough people over 40. And it's suing Bass Pro. Now, both of these companies are implicitly white organizations, implicitly white businesses. They cater to white people. I've been to Texas Roadhouse, and it's got a very nice country music, Old West cowboy flavor that they deliberately cultivate. It's a steakhouse. And Bass Pro is a redneck place for outdoors gear, hunting, fishing, camping, boating, all these things that appeal to white people primarily. And the EEOC is suing them, claiming that they do not hire people because of their race, African American or black, or national origin, Hispanic or Latino. So that's how the EEOC works. That's how our government forces integration of businesses, whether it makes sense or not. That's who it's focused on, is forcing whites to employ non-whites. Another aspect of forced integration is Section 8 housing. This is subsidized housing, and it's more than that. It's giving people vouchers so that they can live in any neighborhood they want, and the government will pay for the rent. And I wrote a blog post about this back in 2010, titled "The Unspeakable Blackness of Section 8 and Crime." Because Section 8, a lot of people pretend that Section 8 is just about poverty. And at the time that I wrote this blog post, a story had come out that made it clear that it's about more than that. It's about blackness. And it's about crime. And it's about the terrible consequences on the communities that these Section 8 people are housed in, at least from my point of view. The story was came from two professors out of the University of Memphis in Memphis, Tennessee, who put their independent studies together. One was a housing studying housing, and one was studying crime. And they put their two maps together on a computer and saw that they overlapped almost perfectly. I'll quote here from my blog post. On the merged map, dense, violent crime areas are shaded dark blue, and Section 8 addresses are represented by little red dots. All of the dark blue areas are covered in little red dots, like bursts of gunfire. The rest of the city has almost no dots. So there we see the consequences, and you can read this blog post for more of the details. But I made the point in that blog post that all of the concern in the articles that I reviewed was for the blacks themselves, that the people who discovered this really didn't want to divulge it. They didn't know how to divulge it, how to basically cover it up, how to excuse it. And ultimately, they did divulge it, but there was no sympathy for the white communities that the Section 8 people had been relocated to, and the crime that they had been exposed to, the violence. No sympathy at all for them. The hero in that story was a man named Alexander Polakoff. As far as I know, he's a Jew. He's described as an ACLU lawyer and a fair housing advocate. And he's important because legal scholars today often compare his case that he brought to the Supreme Court, compare its significance to Brown versus Board of Education, which I'm going to get into next. What he did was he filed suit back in 1966. They were class action suits against Chicago Housing Authority that really brought about this whole Section 8 phenomena. They opened up. Previously, the housing had been restricted to other similar neighborhoods. People couldn't just move into a wealthy neighborhood or any neighborhood they felt like. But after his case, it was all opened up. And this guy, Polakoff, has a strong Jewish identity, and he's specifically talking about blacks and against whites in his work. I mean, that's the sense that you get when you read some of the information that I put in the blog post. He says that ending black ghettos won't end anti-black attitudes any more than ending Jewish ghettos ended anti-Semitism. But it is not easy to find anything in American society that matches the black ghetto for its poisoning effects on attitudes, value, and conduct. Well, yes, there is something that you can find that more than equals it, and it's Section 8 itself. And this whole idea about transplanting blacks for their benefit away from themselves and amongst the white people who don't deserve what they get when those blacks end up in their neighborhoods. Polakoff, earlier in that article, I only discovered this on rereading it myself. It wasn't in my blog post, but he quotes Alexis de Tocqueville in a favoring himself, you know, and his argument. He writes, some 170 years ago, Alexis de Tocqueville called racial inequality, quote, the most formidable evil threatening the future of the United States. Tocqueville went on to prophesy that the evil of racial inequality would not be resolved, indeed that it would eventually bring America to disaster. Well, it has brought America to disaster, and Polakoff, by the way, is misrepresenting Tocqueville. When I looked it up, what Tocqueville actually said, the quote, is, the most formidable of all the ills that threaten the future of the Union arises from the presence of a black population upon its territory, and in contemplating the cause of the present embarrassments or the future dangers of the United States, the observer is invariably led to this as a primary fact. This was in 1835 that he wrote this, and he wrote elsewhere, just to put it in context of what he's talking about, he wrote, you may set the Negro free, but you cannot make him otherwise than an alien to the European. Nor is this all we scarcely acknowledge, the common features of humanity in this stranger whom slavery has brought among us. His physiognomy is, to our eyes, hideous, his understanding weak, his tastes low, and we are almost inclined to look upon him as a being intermediate between man and the brutes. In other words, Tocqueville was able to discriminate blacks from whites in 1835. That brings me to Brown versus Board of Education. This was a Supreme Court of the United States decision made in 1954, and it had to do with overturning the decision that had previously been made in 1898, what's called the Plessy decision of separate but equal. Wikipedia describes Brown versus Board of Education this way. It writes, the plaintiffs in Brown asserted that this system of racial separation, while masquerading as providing separate but equal treatment of both white and black Americans, instead perpetuated inferior accommodation services and treatment for black Americans. In other words, they overturned Plessy and they made a change to the law for the benefit of the blacks. So you could say that white rule ended on this date, if not sometime even earlier. Brown was influenced, the decision was influenced by UNESCO's 1950 statement, signed by a wide variety of internationally renowned scholars. These are the experts I was talking about earlier that use morals and moralizing to justify their claims. And they've titled their statement, their 1950 statement, The Race Question. Now, this is something I didn't know about Brown versus Board of Education. I'm not sure that most people know, and or even most racialists understand, that the intellectual pedigree of that decision goes back to this race question paper. And when I looked that up, I saw that this was the authors of this monstrosity were mostly Jews, or at least half of them were Jews, and some of them notorious Jews, Claude Levi Strauss, Ashley Montague. The race question is described in its entry in Wikipedia as the first of four UNESCO statements about issues of race. It was issued on 18th of July 1950, following World War II and Nazi racism. The statement was an attempt to clarify what was scientifically known about race and a moral condemnation of racism. The Constitution itself, that's the Constitution of the UNESCO, stated that, quote, "the great and terrible war that has now ended was a war made possible by the denial of the democratic principles of the dignity, equality, and mutual respect of men, and by the propagation in their place through ignorance and prejudice of the doctrine of the inequality of men and races." 2 points here about this. One is that Brown versus Board of Education, therefore, came directly out of World War II, and the whole idea of what's good for the Jews, which was being extended to blacks in America. And secondly, they claim that the inequality of men and races is ignorance and prejudice. And it's exactly the opposite. Their idea of equality is what's comes out of ignorance. You have to ignore reality in order to think that races don't exist and that the races are equal. In response to Brown versus Board of Education, one of the responses was something called massive resistance. Massive resistance was a policy declared by U.S. Senator Harry F. Byrd Sr. of Virginia in 1956 in order to unite other white politicians and leaders in Virginia in a campaign of new state laws and policies to prevent public school desegregation. So here we see whites tried to fight. It was coming from the top down, these decisions disarming whites, telling us that we couldn't discriminate and we couldn't exclude others from living amongst us, that we couldn't live amongst ourselves. This came from above, and there was resistance to it. There was something I wanted to note in the Polakoff Section 8 thing. In fact, there was a section there about that. Yeah, here it is. One of the professors, their work grew out of a long history. That was the civil rights movement. The work grew out of a long history of white resistance to blacks moving out of what used to be called the ghetto. During much of the 20th century, white people used bombs and mobs to keep black people out of their neighborhoods. In 1949 in Chicago, a rumor that a black family was moving into a white block prompted a riot that grew to 10,000 people in 4 days. So there's evidence here that whites resisted massively what was being done to them. And that resistance was overcome, unfortunately, eventually. I have another article that I'll link. This is a modern day article from the Department of Justice and Department of Education. It's actually on ed.gov, which I guess is the Department of Education's website. And just to, make it clear that this hasn't gone away. This isn't something that happened in the 50s and has been going away. Now, as we get to a race-blind, post-racial society, it's actually in higher gear than before. The language here is dishonest, as most of the rest of the language having to do with race and equality is. The catchphrase here is to achieve diversity or avoid racial isolation. This piece that I'm going to link is guidelines for how to achieve diversity or avoid racial isolation in schools. And what I'd like to know is, when did the pursuit of happiness, when did defending our country, which is what the government's main responsibility is, become about forcing people to live together, compelling them to mix? Well, as we see, it goes back at least as far as 1950 and 1954. Let me read a paragraph here. Conversely, where schools lack a diverse student body or are racially isolated, i.e. composed overwhelmingly of students of one race, they may fail to provide the full panoply of benefits that K-12 through 12 schools can offer. The academic achievement of students at racially isolated schools often lags behind that of their peers at more diverse schools. Racially isolated schools often have fewer effective teachers, higher teacher turnover rates, less rigorous curricular resources, and inferior facilities and other educational resources. Reducing racial isolation in schools is also important because students who are not exposed to racial diversity in school often lack other opportunities to interact with students from different racial backgrounds. Why is it important to mix? Why is diversity so important? It's important for the non-whites. They're the ones that it's important to. It's not important to whites. If it were important to whites wouldn't be trying to run away from it, trying to get away from it. And that brings me to the second part here of what I want to discuss tonight, and that is white flight. White flight is, I think everyone's probably heard of this, and some people may have even experienced it themselves firsthand. I know I have. I have left where I used to live, and I was looking for a better place for myself and my family to live. A nicer neighborhood with better schools. And I found it. And I'll talk more about that another time. I don't have time to do that tonight. But white flight in Wikipedia is defined as white flight is a term that originated in the United States starting in the mid-20th century and applied to the large-scale migration of whites of various European ancestries from racially mixed urban regions to more racially homogenous suburban or exurban regions. It was first seen as originating from fear and anxiety about increasing minority populations. No kidding. That's absolutely true. The article also discusses white flight since then. Specifically, I remember it mentioned South Africa, but just about every white country. In the case of South Africa, it's whites actually fleeing the country as a whole. In the United States, the phenomena is moving from one part of the country to the other, to another, usually from urban to suburban, as they say. But what are we running away from? We're running away from integration. We're running away from non-whites. That's what we're fleeing. And usually this is painted as us being stupid, crazy, evil racists. We're crazy. We don't know what we're doing. But we obviously do know what we're doing. We're doing it in vast numbers and for an extended period of time. It's really the only thing that we have left to do besides fighting. And actually, we did fight at first and for a variety of reasons gave up that fight and have resorted now to fleeing for the most part. However, some historians, this is continuing with Wikipedia, some historians have challenged the phrase white flight as a misnomer whose use should be reconsidered. In her study of Chicago's West Side during the post-war era, historian Amanda Seligman, who I'm guessing is Jewish, argues that the phrase misleadingly suggests that whites immediately departed when blacks moved into the neighborhood, when in fact many whites defended their space with violence, intimidation, or legal tactics. And again, that's the point, one of the points I want to make tonight is that whites did try to defend our living space. We did try to stand up for what was ours and before fleeing. Fleeing was sort of a last resort after being betrayed by our leadership, really. And the final story that I want to discuss tonight is called Whitetopia. It's actually an article from Time magazine titled America's Booming White Enclaves, and it's a brief interview with a black journalist named Rich Benjamin, who wrote a book. This was dated back in 2009, October of 2009. The title of his book was Searching for Whitetopia, an Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. And they ask him, what's a Whitetopia? And he describes it as more than just a place where a lot of white people live. He describes it as a place where, let's see, it has three things. First, it has more than 6% population growth since 2000. So he's looking at growing areas, where places where the population is increasing. Second thing is that the majority of that growth, upwards of 90%, comes from white migrants. And the third thing is that it has an ineffable social charm, a pleasant look and feel. It's a nice place. In fact, they go on, he goes on to say, well, actually, the interviewer asks him the question, says, you say that many Whitopias offer a higher or a high quality of life and tend to perform well on those best places to live lists that run in magazines. Do you think people are also drawn to these places specifically for their whiteness? Benjamin answers and says that the major draw, in his opinion, to Whitopia is that they're safe communities with good public schools and beautiful natural resources. He's right about all of this. And the next question is, what is the danger Whitopias pose to America as a whole? And as a black man, the danger he sees is that that whites want to be free of blacks. Whites want to separate themselves from blacks. That's the danger. And he rationalizes it. Let's see if I can find that spot. He says, you can call me old-fashioned, but I'm an integrationist. A democracy can't function at its optimum unless all the members are integrated as full members. That's a bunch of nonsense. A democracy can't function if you're forcing some of the people that are supposedly participating to participate in a certain way. Then they're not really enjoying democracy, at least not as it's advertised. I wanted to make another point here about he says that he rejects the argument that this is natural, that birds of a feather flock together. He rejects that. And I reject his argument. I think segregation is indeed human nature. And in fact, these things I've been reviewing here are white phenomena. These are the white reaction to being forced to live with aliens. Massive resistance, white flight, whitetopias, these are all massive phenomena reflecting the character and the behavior of a whole race of people. Whites expending our wealth, uplooting our lives, and taking action to try and live amongst our own kind. The real difference between whiteness and blackness is driven home by this example here. There are no blacktopias, because blacks make any place that they live a less desirable place for everyone else to live. Even blacks don't want to live amongst other blacks, as we see in the Section 8 example. Mexican President Calderon, former President Calderon, said, wherever a Mexican goes, there is Mexico. Well, wherever an African goes, there is Africa. There eventually is a dirty, dilapidated, violent slum. Whites once had governments which favored us over others, and now we have governments which actively favor the others, and they do that regardless of the harm that it causes whites. It's a fraud. They talk about equality. They talk about fairness. It isn't.